Hey, Levitt, can I read you a story?
Sure.
Okay. So, I'm going to tell you this story.
A little girl named Mary goes to the beach with her mother and brother.
A little girl named Mary goes to the beach with her mother and brother.
They drive there in a red car.
At the beach,
they swim,
eat some ice cream,
play in the sand,
and have some sandwiches for lunch. So that's the end of the short story.
Now, Levitt, let me ask you a few questions about it.
So now I'm going to ask you the questions. Ready?
Number one, what color was the car?
I think it might have been red.
What color was the car?
The car was red.
Fantastic.
Number two, did they have fish and chips for lunch?
No, they had sandwiches.
Yes, they did have fish and chips for lunch.
No, they do not have fish and chips for lunch.
What do they have?
Sandwiches.
They had sandwiches.
Number three, did they listen to music in the car?
No, they didn't.
I'm sure they did. Doesn't everyone listen to music?
Did they listen to music in the car?
No, they didn't listen to music in the car.
And number four, did they drink lemonade with their lunch?
No, they didn't drink lemonade with their lunch.
Probably not. Most people drink soda.
What flavor ice cream did Mary have?
I don't know.
Mary had chocolate flavor ice cream.
What flavor ice cream did Mary have?
Mary had vanilla ice cream.
What flavor ice cream did Mary have? You can say I don't know.
Strawberry?
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
In 2014, Steve Levitt and I, he's my Freakonomics friend and co-author and economist at the University of Chicago, we published a book called Think Like a Freak. One chapter is called The Three Hardest Words in the English Language. Now, what do you think those words are? In the past, some have argued that people have a hard time saying, I love you. I don't think so. People run around saying, I love you all the time to friends, to pets, to strangers. So what are those three most difficult words? So Levitt, one piece of business advice that people give all over the web, LinkedIn, and you just read all the regular kind of job searching career advice places. One big piece of advice I give is when you're in a job interview, there's one thing you should never say to the person interviewing you, which is, I don't know. You should never admit you don't know the answer to a question. Think that's pretty good advice?
That actually probably is good advice for an interview. That probably is...
Just say interview?
That probably is good advice for a job interview, but it is terrible advice for life.
And why is that such terrible advice for life?
Let me try to answer that by example. So we wrote Freakonomics, and because it was deemed a business book and we sold a lot of copies, that made us business experts. And since we wrote that book, I've been asked a ton, you as well, to go talk to companies and give them advice. And what's amazing to me, and I've kept very close attention over the last decade almost, is I could count on one hand the number of occasions in which someone in a company, in front of their boss, on a question that they might possibly have ever been expected to know the answer, has said, I don't know. Within the business world, there's a general view that your job is to be an expert. And no matter how much you have to fake or how much you're making it up, that you just should give an answer and hope for the best afterwards. And I've seen it teaching the business school students that they're incredibly good, the MBAs, at faking like they know the answer when they have no idea. But that's so counterproductive. I mean, think about it. It might keep your job for another week or another month. It might make people think you're good. But that's not the point. I mean, what fun is life if all you do is go through life trying to fake like you're something that you're not, when really the goal is to be good and to improve and to learn and to make things better. And the only way to do that is to start by saying, I don't know. When I don't know, I don't know.
All right, so it's easy to ridicule the fakers and bluffers of the world, but we can understand their motivation, can't we? Everyone wants to look smart, look competent, look like we belong. But wouldn't it be even better if, as Levitt says, we could improve and learn, actually make things better? If you think so, listen on. Let's try to figure out where this reluctance to say, I don't know, comes from. Hi, Amanda.
Hey, Stephen.
Amanda Waterman teaches developmental psychology at the University of Leeds. A lot of her research is about people's willingness, especially children's willingness, to say, I don't know. Her early research looked at whether kids would say, I don't know, when asked a patently ridiculous question.
What do feet have for breakfast?
Toenails if you chop them off.
Smelly socks.
You can say, I don't know.
They have your skin. They have a walk for breakfast.
Shoes and socks for breakfast.
Okay, next question. Is red heavier than yellow?
Don't really know that one.
Is red heavier than yellow?
Oh, no. No, because yellow is my favourite colour.
Bella, what do you think?
I think it is heavier than yellow because red is in hell and then yellow's in the sky, isn't it? Yeah, so it's down below, down there.
Is a jumper angrier than a tree?
No.
Is a jumper angrier than a tree?
No, because trees look like they have faces. Yes, a jumper is angrier than a tree because you can pick jumpers up and that's how they move. And trees just go like this.
They
sway from side to side in the wind.
So, Amanda, is a sweater, what you there call a jumper, angrier than a tree?
Okay, well, that's perhaps where this research started, where we asked children very silly questions about whether a jumper or indeed a sweater was angrier than a tree, to see whether they would indicate in any way whether they were confused by the question or whether they would just go along with the sort of fun spirit of the question. And we found that often children did want to decide whether a jumper was angrier than a tree. But we moved on after that. I was more interested in looking
at
whether...
You got bored by that stuff, didn't you?
I got bored. Jumpers are obviously more angry than trees, right? So.
Oh, really? I thought trees...
No, jumpers were definitely angrier because I think they're kind of used by people. You know, they have to be put on and off all the time.
I see.
Kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But we were more interested in looking at perhaps something that would be a little bit more applicable to real life, because generally adults don't ask you very silly questions all the time, but you do come across questions to which you do not know the answer. So it might be a perfectly sensible question, but you just happen not to know the answer to it. So the research went on from silly questions to what we've called unanswerable questions.
Which brings us back to the story you heard earlier about the little girl named Mary.
A little girl named Mary goes to the beach with her mother and brother.
This story was part of a study that Amanda Waterman ran to see how children will answer a question that is essentially unanswerable, a question to which the most sensible answer is, I don't know. In the story about Mary and her family going to the seashore, we learn several facts. The car was red. They ate sandwiches for lunch. But other facts are not given to us. Did they listen to music in the car? We aren't told that. Did they have lemonade with their sandwiches? We don't know.
Did they drink lemonade with their lunch?
No, they didn't drink lemonade with their lunch.
Did they listen to music in the car? You can say, I don't know.
No, they didn't listen to music in the car.
The vast majority of children pretend they know the answer to unanswerable questions.
It has varied between studies, but you're looking at maybe two-thirds to three-quarters of children, and we're talking in the age range here of about 5 to 8 years old, would say, yes or no to a yes, no question that we know they don't know the answer to.
So these kids are preparing themselves very well for careers in business or politics, maybe as a pundit of some sort, or wherever else in society people pretend to know more than they do. Now, why is this impulse so strong among children?
Personally, what I think is going on is that the children are very used to a classroom situation. Obviously, you do get asked questions by your parent as a child, but a lot of question-answer exchanges happen in school. Teachers ask kids questions all the time to ascertain what they're picking up from the lesson, etc. And generally in that situation, it's sensible to have a go. You know, you don't generally earn many points for saying, I don't know, when a teacher asks a question. So having a go and actually feeling good that maybe you have that piece of knowledge and that you can show, you know, that you are clever. So I think that when it seems like a test situation, they fall back on what they've already started to learn from the context that they spend a lot of time in.
I guess when you describe that as an academic setting, even an academic setting among children, it reminds me of certainly academic settings among older people, university and so on. But it also reminds me of settings in the workplace where very often when a question is raised, someone is expected to know the answer. And maybe the asker of the question, if they don't necessarily know the answer, they certainly have strong opinions about it. So I'm curious about how you would connect what you see in young children with what you see among the rest of us, adults, in whether it's the work world or politics or policy, things like that.
Yeah, well, I think that ties back into this whole social aspect of any kind of conversation or dialogue or question answer exchange, where a lot of how you respond is affected by how you perceive the expectations of the person asking the question. So it's not just about giving a straight factual answer as to the state of your knowledge. It's actually trying to work out all the other contexts that surround why that question has been asked. What do you think the interviewer wants from you? And I think children do start to do that from a very young age. I think one of the things that happens with kids, but you can actually definitely apply this to adult conversations, is that there's quite a power differential between a child and an adult who's asking them a question. And the child will feel that the adult is the person that has more of the power, and therefore perhaps they feel slightly disadvantaged. They feel like they want to show what they can do. They don't feel as comfortable admitting when they don't know something. That clearly applies across into the work context with adults, where you have a boss with an employee or you have somebody who's higher up the hierarchy than you are, and you feel that expectation that, as you say, somebody should know the answer to this.
As it turns out, Waterman also tested some adults with unanswerable questions. How'd they do?
We found that about a quarter of the adults tried to answer the yes-no unanswerable questions.
Now, at least that's better than the three-quarters of the kids who couldn't bring themselves to say, I don't know, but still, not very encouraging. Think about it for a minute. When's the last time someone you know, maybe even yourself, gave a firm answer to a question that you really didn't know? Maybe a week ago? An hour ago? Maybe just now? Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, the consequences of not being able to admit what you don't know.
It's easier to spend $1 billion pretending they knew than to actually find out the answer.
And what we can do about it.
There's only one way to learn, and that's through feedback.
And we'd love your feedback. Tell us what you think of Freakonomics Radio. You can tweet us at Freakonomics, find us on Facebook, or leave a review in the iTunes podcast store or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, go ahead and subscribe to this show so that you'll never miss another episode.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
One of the first steps in learning to think like a freak is learning to say, I don't know. Why? Because until you can admit what you don't know, it's virtually impossible to learn what you need to. Because if you think you already have all the answers, you won't go looking for them. But let's be clear, simply saying I don't know isn't a solution. It's just a first step. You have to figure out what you don't know and then work like a dog to learn it. And how do you learn?
There's only one way to learn, and that's through feedback.
That's Steve Levitt again.
The thing about always faking is that if you fake like you know the answer, you don't have the freedom to explore other possibilities. But if you actually care about the outcome and the truth, saying I don't know is critical. One thing we've learned is that the only way to learn is through feedback. That whether you're a human being, an animal, an organization, the way that you learn is by trying different things and seeing the outcome when you try different approaches and comparing those outcomes.
Feedback comes in many flavors. It might mean going out and asking a lot of questions, might mean gathering a lot of data. If the data don't happen to be just lying around waiting to be plucked, you may have to generate data yourself. How? One great way is to run some kind of an experiment. If you want to think like a freak, you need to fall in love with experimentation. Now, scientists have been doing this for centuries. The rest of us? Not so much. But why should scientists have all the fun?
So something that puzzled me for the longest time when I started working with firms, that I would preach to them the gospel of experimentation, of either randomized experiments or accidental experiments, just all the things that I do. And always it was met with great enthusiasm. Of course, yeah, you know, experiments, that's the way to go. And then when it actually came down to it, we could almost never convince anyone to do things experimentally.
Why don't they want to do it? What are they reluctant about? Are they afraid it's going to be expensive, that they won't know how to do it, that it's going to embarrass them? What's the problem?
For years, I struggled with trying to understand what it was. And I thought, was it expensive? Well, no, I could design it in ways that it really wouldn't cost them anything. Would it take too long, too many resources? I mean, it was none of that. And it finally hit me, what was totally obvious, is that in order to run an experiment, you have to start from the premise that you don't know what the right answer is. So I don't know if I should do the red version or the blue version. Should I price high? Should I price low? Should I give people a money-back guarantee or shouldn't I? So all of those are questions that might be perfect for trying to answer with an experiment. But in order to be willing to run the experiment, you have to say, well, geez, I don't know the answer. Wait, but you're the expert. You're in charge of marketing. You're in charge of pricing. You're supposed to know the answer. And so the people in the firms we were working with felt so much pressure to be the expert that they wouldn't run the experiments because that was an admission that they weren't really as expert as they maybe had been pretending to be or other people wanted them to pretend to be.
Levitt, in addition to teaching at the University of Chicago, helps run a consulting firm.
One of my favorite early stories, this might have been the very first company that I went to visit.
This was a company whose unwillingness to experiment, to admit what they didn't know, had pretty big consequences. It was a huge multinational retailer. They spent many millions of dollars in advertising in the U.S. alone, but they weren't sure how effective the advertising was. So far, they'd come to one concrete conclusion: that TV ads were about four times more effective, dollar for dollar, than print ads. Now, how'd they know this? That's what their sales data told them. They advertised every week in newspapers, but because TV advertising is so expensive, they only bought ads three times a year: Black Friday, Christmas, and Father's Day.
So then I said, I think I might understand why your TV ads seem to have a return on investment that's four times as great as your newspaper ads. And they said, why? I said, well, every single time you go and do a big advertising campaign, your sales go through the roof right afterwards. And like, yeah, at Father's Day, Thanksgiving, and Christmas. I said, but don't you think maybe even if you didn't do the ads, you would sell more stuff around Christmas and on Black Friday? And they said, yeah.
So basically, this company is spending hundreds of millions of dollars on TV advertising to persuade people to go to their stores to buy stuff on the three times of the year when people were already going to be going to stores to buy stuff.
Exactly right.
So what about the print ads? This retailer had run newspaper ads pretty much every Sunday for 20 years in more than 200 markets. How effective were they? It was hard to know.
So I go to them and I say, I think you cannot learn from the existing data the answer to your question. And to their credit, they said, well, geez, this is a really important question for us. How could we learn the truth? And I said, well, TV ads are tougher. I don't even know how we'll ever learn that. But the newspaper insert, that's an easy one. So you said you have a couple hundred markets, and I did some calculations about how much power we would have if we did a randomized experiment. And I think I would need you to give me about 40 of your newspaper markets. And I would randomly assign 20 of those to a control group where we wouldn't do any newspaper inserts for about 3 months. And we will compare the sales in the markets where you kept on doing the inserts to the ones where you didn't do inserts. And by doing that comparison, we would learn with a great degree of confidence what the impact of newspaper inserts on sales.
And did you expect them to say, hey, that's a fantastic idea, and just think of all the money we'll save by not buying the ads, that's even cheaper. Did you expect them to be enthusiastic about it?
They were spending hundreds of millions of dollars a year on these newspaper inserts. They had no idea if they worked. And they even had this belief, which I'm almost certain was erroneous anyway, but they had reason to believe the newspaper inserts weren't that good relative to TV. So I thought, for sure, this is a no-brainer. This is easy. Of course, you know, let's get rolling. How fast can we get it started?
And what was their response?
So we went to them with the proposal, and their reaction surprised me. They said, are you crazy? We can't not advertise in 20 markets. We'll all get fired. And they went on. One of the other guys chimed in and said, yeah, you know, we once had this summer intern, an MBA that we had hired, and one of his jobs was to do the ordering of the media in different cities. And the guy was so incompetent that for reasons we never really figured out, he just forgot to order the newspaper inserts for a big chunk of Pittsburgh for the entire summer. And just kind of joking around with him, I said, well, I hope you hired that guy. And he said, hired him? He was terrible. We would never hire him. Why should we hire him? I said, well, at least he was terrible in just the right way that you're all too chicken to be terrible. Because I said, what happened to the sales in your stores in Pittsburgh when this guy forgot to do the newspaper inserts?
So what did happen?
To their credit, they went and they looked at the data. And they called me with a spring of excitement in their voice. And they said to me, you're not going to believe what we found. We found no impact whatsoever on the sales in Pittsburgh when this guy didn't put in the ads. And I said, wow, that's amazing. All right, so when can we start the experiment? Again, I just need 40 markets, and I'll randomly assign them, and we'll stop the ads for 3 months. And they said, after a pause, they said, are you crazy? We can't not advertise in 20 markets. The CEO will kill us. And it's really amazing that the only piece of real learning they had, the only piece of real feedback that they were given, is that the newspaper inserts didn't work. And yet, it's now 5 years later, and they've probably spent close to another $1 billion putting ads in the newspaper. And the reason was because if they tried to do an experiment to see whether newspaper inserts worked or not, it would be admission that they did not know whether newspaper inserts worked. It's easier to spend $1 billion pretending they knew than to actually find out the answer.
It's easy to criticize people who get locked into pretending to know answers that they don't. But as we said at the beginning of this program, those three little words, I don't know, can be really hard to say.
First, it takes a lot of confidence to be willing to say, I don't know. And I think actually it's easy for someone like me to say, I don't know, because, you know, I've had some success. We sold some books. I've done well in academics. So if I say, I don't know, people say, oh, isn't that cute? The Midwestern self-deprecating, blah, blah, blah. But if you're just, you know, a middle manager in a firm and you say, I don't know, people look around, they're like, this guy doesn't know? What's wrong with him?
So the incentives to fake it, to never admit you don't know an answer, are pretty strong. But maybe there's a way to flip those incentives, to encourage people to say, I don't know, when they really don't know. Remember Amanda Waterman, the British psychologist who studies kids? We went back to her with this. So we make the argument that people should be much more willing to admit what they don't know, especially in settings, whether it is business or academia or politics, where you're dealing not just with a simple set of facts or even a simple set of beliefs, but with a process, or, you know, when you're trying to tease out cause and effect, which can be very complicated, not only in the, certainly in the future, what policy will work, but even trying to understand what has worked in the past. And we make the argument that it would be better if more people admitted what they didn't know, because that is kind of the first step on the road to learning and discovery and getting feedback and running some experiments, perhaps, to find out what's real. I'm just curious whether you would endorse that argument of ours, or whether you think that's not really a principal obstacle.
No, I absolutely endorse it. And I would go back a little to saying that I guess at least part of the responsibility lies with the people who are at the top of whatever hierarchy you happen to be talking about. If you create a culture where it's okay to say, do you know, I don't know the answer to that, but wouldn't it be good to find out? Then I think you can, that then perpetuates through the organization. But I think the problem is, I guess, that the people that have come up to the top are maybe used to having got to the top, possibly by not admitting when they didn't know the answer. So perhaps that you get that cycle. But no, I absolutely agree with you that saying you don't know appropriately is a good thing.
So let's break that cycle, shall we? Let's start with the generation that really matters.
You can say, I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know, miss.
I don't know.
That's perfectly fine.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, it's time for some frequently asked questions. We put them to Kevin Kelly, one of the founders of Wired magazine. He tells us how he got started in publishing.
I think I was the first person in the world to be hired online in 1983.
And then there's this. When's the last time you dropped acid, Kevin?
I tell you, there's nothing more boring than hearing someone's acid trip.
And if you want to hear every episode of Freakonomics Radio ever made for free, visit us at Freakonomics.com or at iTunes. You can also follow Freakonomics on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Kevin Kelly is a technology writer and a founder of Wired magazine. He lives and works in Northern California in a rambling house at the end of a road just a mile from the Pacific Ocean, as he puts it. Usually, when we record an interview like this one, we either make someone go to a studio or we send an engineer to them with a portable recorder. But Kelly, being Kelly, offered to record himself. So what you're hearing today is me asking him questions from a radio studio in New York, and Kelly responding from his writing studio in California, recording himself on a small digital recorder with two built-in microphones. It's called a Zoom H2 Handy. Later, he uploaded the file to Dropbox. We downloaded it. And to borrow Kelly's words, we zippered it into the half of the conversation that we recorded in New York. So that's what you're hearing as Kevin Kelly answers our frequently asked questions. Okay, so let's start. Tell us who you are and what you do.
My name is Kevin Kelly. I'm senior maverick at Wired magazine, a magazine that I co-founded about 20 years ago. And what I do is write books about the consequences of technology, the impact of technology in our lives, which is really what Wired was about, the culture around technology rather than technology itself.
And Kevin, tell me in 60 seconds or so what you actually do in a given day.
I spend most of my day reading. I read magazines and books, and then I try and write a little about what I learned. Of course, I also write emails. Then I take a hike or a bike, and I also try to take one photograph a day. So I mostly spend my time reading.
Sounds like a pretty pleasant way to spend a day, yes?
It's absolutely a great way because I'm spending time reading and I realize most people don't have that privilege. And so I am reading books so that you don't have to.
And you somehow make a living doing all this, yeah?
Yeah, I do. And not on a typical day, but I also do speaking, which is really where the income from writers comes these days.
Now, Kevin, what would you say would be the best investment you've made, any kind of investment, financial, emotional, education, whatever, that's got you to where you are today?
I spent almost a decade traveling in Asia with very little money, and that transformed my life, and it gave me insights into how things are actually done. And I also caught a really bad case of optimism there because I saw with my own eyes nations bootstrapping themselves from poverty into prosperity.
This was after you went to college but did not graduate from college, correct?
Right. I did 1 year of college and then dropped out. And instead, I awarded myself a graduate degree in Asian studies by backpacking through Asia at a time when it was in transition.
And what is your advice to people today who are thinking about not going to college or dropping out of college?
I think you don't need college if you have a project that you want to throw yourself into, if you have the gumption and the discipline, if you have a really good alternative. And I've told my kids, if you don't have that, then you've got to go to college.
And what's their college status?
They all went because they didn't have something as an alternative.
Kevin, who's been the biggest influence on your life or work and why?
A man called Stuart Brand, who taught me how to think honestly. He was the first publisher and creator of the Whole Earth Catalog, which I read in high school. And the message of that kind of hippie Bible was you can invent your life to do whatever you want and that you don't need to ask permission.
And you went on then to be an editor at the Whole Earth Catalog, yes?
I did. The only job I ever wanted to have was to work for the Whole Earth Catalog because I felt that it was speaking to me directly. I was hired in a kind of a curious way. I was hired online. I think I was the first person in the world to be hired online in 1983.
Wow. What was the portal that allowed you to do that?
It was an experimental online network called EIES, E-I-E-S, run by the New Jersey Institute of Technology. And I finagled my way into it by, I had become a travel writer at that time, and I was writing about this network nation as if it was a new territory. And I apparently had the right voice for online. And we recognize that voice these days as the voice of a blogger.
And that, I guess, directly or indirectly led to you belonging to a group of people who ended up starting Wired Magazine, yes? I mean, it's kind of a continuous thread.
Yes, it was. But I mean, before that, I launched the first Hackers Conference with Stuart. We also launched The Well, which was the first public access to the internet in 84 or 85.
Given the modern face of cutting-edge technology, let's invite everybody out there to summon the image of a person who represents that. And it might be a Steve Jobs-like character. It might be someone a generation or two generations younger than that. But you guys were a bunch of hippies that really kickstarted what we now know as the digital revolution. I think most people don't think of the digital revolution today as being affiliated with hippiedom at all.
They don't. And that is actually one of the untold stories. Actually, it was told by the New York Times technology writer John Markoff, who wrote a kind of overlooked book called What the Dormouse Said, which was telling the hippie origins of the personal computer and how basically from Doug Engelbart and Steve Jobs and Stuart Brand, they were all dropping acid. They were trying to augment human cognition, not trying to make a new industry. And a lot of the earliest entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley in the computer world were former hippies who were living on communes and learned some small business skills, making candles or macrame or whatever it was, and transferred that into this ethic of the entrepreneur, which is now kind of all fancy and hip. And that is definitely a thread of Silicon Valley that's not widely appreciated.
Yeah. When's the last time you dropped acid, Kevin?
I have only dropped acid once in my life, and I was 50 years old on my birthday.
Yeah, which was how long ago? You're how old?
I'm 62. So I took no drugs at all, even though I was a hippie. I was one of those weird ones that didn't do drugs. But I decided to make it a sacrament. And on my 50th birthday, I dropped 3 tabs of acid and saw God.
What did God look like? What did she say?
I tell you, there's nothing more boring than hearing someone's acid trip.
I don't know. I've never done acid. Was it positive, at least?
It was a positive experience, and I did a lot of research on trying to find out how you do this well, and it turns out that was actually kind of hard to find. But you do it with a guide in the right setting. So I did it outdoors. I had a very experienced person who was sitting by me and taking care of me and leading me through. And I also had a source for the drug that was very pure. However, I have to say that I was given 4 tabs and I threw the last one into the ocean when I was done, saying, you know, I don't need to do that again.
What do you collect and why?
You know, I don't have that collector gene. I have a couple little things that I collected on my travels in Asia, and one was Coke bottles. And I collected the Coke bottles because the different countries in Asia, they had different scripts.
Coke is bottled locally everywhere in the world, isn't it?
Right. And so that was the interest to me. It was this universal symbol that had these local variations, and I thought that was really cool. You know, the Chinese and the Japanese and the Thai, they were all different, and yet they were all the same in some ways, too, the same shape.
Kevin, what can you tell us about your strategy for creating and managing computer passwords?
I use a mnemonic formula to generate passwords that are kind of specific to each site that I go to. So it's a formula that uses part of the site's name in the password.
So yours is algorithm-ish that's
right.
Adaptable to any site then, yes?
Exactly. So my assistant could generate it if needed, and we'd all agree on what it was, and yet it's unique to that site.
What's your net worth compared to that of your parents when you were, let's say, 16?
I didn't know what my parents' net worth was. I still don't know. We never talked about it.
What'd your folks do for a living?
My father actually worked for Time Life. He was not an editorial site. He was in something that was called operations research at the time that we would now call like IT. He was one of the people who brought computers to the magazine world. And then later on, he was involved in this really kind of weird startup that you might have heard of called HBO. And so he was involved with the guys who were taking cable TV and trying to put it up onto a satellite.
So did you grow up in New York then?
I grew up in New Jersey, in Westfield, New Jersey. My dad worked in New York, and my parents never talked politics. I have no idea how they ever voted. I don't even know what they were making. And so I don't have any idea.
Okay, but how about your life and your family and consumption patterns and so on? Would you say you're financially better off or worse off than your parents?
Well, I'm sure we're as well off, and we might be better off, but it's all relative. For instance, when I grew up, I never ate out in a restaurant my entire life. Every meal my mom cooked, I don't know whether we couldn't afford it. It was just that we didn't do it. Now, that's not obviously true of my own life, but I don't know if that was more about money or more just about the culture at the time.
What was your favorite meal that your mom made?
Tuna fish salad. And we were raised Catholic, so we had it on Friday. And, you know, that's something I just always looked forward to.
Kevin, what do you worry about now when you go to sleep at night?
I don't worry about anything when I go to sleep at night. I am kind of a machine that can just be turned off and turned on. I've constructed my life to try and have very few regrets and no worries. And so while I may worry about like whether this is really recording or not, I'm not worrying about things at night.
So you're an in-the-moment worrier. You're not a retrospective worrier.
Right, exactly.
What is one thing throughout your life, maybe, that you've spent too much on but do not regret?
My library. I have a 2-story library filled with lots of books. You know, I've read maybe 2/3 of them, so there's lots of books that I haven't read. They take up a lot of space, but I just love it. I just would not give it up for anything.
These days, do you typically buy a book on paper or an e-version?
I'm buying both, so I can have multiple versions of books, and that's certainly an indulgence.
When someone comes over to your house and they're in your library and they see a book that they are interested in, what do you do? Do you give it to them? Do
you... You know, I wish I was freer with my books in giving them away, but no, I don't give them the book. Anyone who visits my library gets a book from me, but it's usually a book that I have made, and I produce two or three books a year, little things that I print on Blurb or Lulu. So I'm a kind of recovering photographer, and they can range from photo books, or I have other little private books, a book on drawings that I've done over the years. So I have a little stash of private editions, and that's what I give away.
So one of the books that you've made, but that's on a much bigger scale than the ones you're talking about here, is this amazingly interesting book, Cool Tools. Tell us about that a little bit.
So Cool Tools is a book on paper, and it's only available on paper, that's a little bit oversized.
It's a lot oversized. Come on.
Yeah. If you open it up, it's kind of like a small towel, the size of a dish towel. And it is about 1,500 recommendations for cool tools. And tool is in the broadest sense of something that's useful to you. So it could be a hand tool, like a really good pair of pliers, or it could be the best glue gun in the world, or it could be something like a piece of software or a software app, or it could be something even like a service like Elance, which is this global market for freelancers. And they're collected and arranged into this book that does something that your phone doesn't do or the web doesn't do, which is all these things arranged on a page and the design of them being adjacent to one another. There's something unconscious that provokes in your mind connections between them. So there's a kind of a buzz, an exhilaration you get because your brain is making associations between all these tools.
You know, when I first got Cool Tools, I guess it came out in 2013, and I loved it, and I loved looking through it, and my kids love looking through it, and we like to give it away as a present for high school graduation or even bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs because it's like there's a world out there, and there's you here, and you are going into that world, and it's very easy to hear about the 10 things that everybody is talking about at the same time in media, social media, mass media, whatever. But then here's another 1,000 things that you may not know about and that are often better, cheaper, easier, and will kind of help you make your way through the world. When I first got it and started looking at it, I thought it was just weird that you, the guy that we, or I at least, associate with Wired Magazine, has put out this book, which is on paper with everything from modern and cutting-edge tools to a lot of things about beekeeping and homesteading and keeping chickens and so on and so. And I thought it was just the greatest contradiction that the Wired guy would also be the super hippie guy, even if he's the modern hippie guy. But now that we're talking, I see no contradiction whatsoever. And I guess what I'm saying is that I like that talking to you has made me, and I hope other people see the connection between, you know, going low, lo-fi and DIY and all that with the highest of the high tech, that they really are connected, aren't they?
Yes, I think of myself as a minimalist in the sense that I'm looking for the minimum amount of technology that will maximize my options. So while I am in my role of Wired and cheerleader for the benefits of technology, I'm trying to maximize the number of choices we have in the world. I'm trying to actually minimize the number of things in my own life at the same time. That's sort of why I'm not Amish. The Amish are minimites in the sense that they are really very selectively choosing.
Although you look Amish with the beard. People mistake you for Amish.
People say that I'm Amish, but I'm not Amish.
You're Amish-ish.
I'm Amish-ish in the sense that I am minimizing the number in my life. But the Amish are not interested in maximizing the number of options in the world, and I am. So Cool Tools, I subtitle as a catalog of possibilities because I'm not encouraging people to buy all the tools in there. I mean, you kind of page through it and you say, oh, I want this, I want that. It's more important that you know that these exist rather than that you purchase them because a tool is really just an opportunity with a handle. It's just a way of thinking about something differently that we make real. And so you can use this as a resource of getting ideas about what is possible to do. And that's why I think it's really great for young people is to say, look, you know, you've been through school, you've been through college, but here's a whole realm of things that are possible for an individual to do these things. You can rent a bulldozer if you want to. You can design your own home and build your own home if you want to. It's not that difficult. And so just knowing that can give you confidence to do other things that haven't been done yet.
Let me ask you a series of favorite questions that are, honestly, these are the kind of questions that if you were asking me, I'd hate them. But so what's a favorite book or author?
Favorite author is Andy Dillard.
And oh, no
kidding. Her book, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, was something that just made me want to write. And I can read that any time of day or night and just be filled with excitement. And I read anything by her, and it's, to me, she's just genius.
Favorite music?
Arabic pop.
Huh. Name some names.
I don't even know what their names are. They're just compilations, and they play, and I don't even know who the artists are, and they're probably not even well known. Hmm. It's kind of like folk music.
Let me ask you this. When it comes to regret, and you've already told us that you are pretty good at not hanging on to regret, at least at the end of a day, do you tend to have stronger regrets for things you did that worked out poorly or things that you didn't do?
Probably for things I didn't do, just because they were kind of opportunities lost.
Do you have a list of those things that you had a chance at?
No, I don't have very, I have very, very few of them. And one of the ones that had we done it a little differently, and we do have a regret, is we didn't have a fourth child.
Why? What would four do that the first three didn't?
You know, our last son was a little bit younger than, it was a little bit separated from the older two. So it would have been a little funner for him. And just, you know, as we went along, we realized how incredibly fantastic it was to have a household of kids around. Mm. And so, but things in terms of timing and jobs and biology just didn't work out.
Kevin, what's one story that your family always tells about you?
I think the story I hear is about when I was a young kid in middle school, I actually made a chemistry lab in my basement. I was really infatuated with chemistry, and I had the glassware and the whole thing, and I built the benches, and I did experiments down there. And I think I was the only kid in the country with a chemical lab that didn't make a bomb.
What were you interested in doing?
I was interested in making colorful, kind of cool demos, things changing colors or building crystals, growing crystals, doing plating, electroplating.
How old were you?
You know, I was 12 or something like that.
Pretty good. I remember I got a chemistry set for my birthday or something when I was, I don't know, probably maybe 10, 11, 12. And I thought I hit on something amazing because I put together sodium and chloride and I made salt. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to be rich. And then I realized it cost me about $10 to make about 2 cents worth of salt. So you were quite a bit ahead of me, weren't you?
Yeah, no, I had a neighbor across the street who worked at Merck, and I would give him lists of chemicals that I wanted, and he very graciously...
And you never made anything explosive, not even gunpowder?
No, I didn't. I'm a very cautious person, and I just knew that that was not a good idea.
Here's a big one. There are a few people I can think of that I'd rather ask this question of than you, Kevin Kelly. What's the best possible future discovery or invention?
I think a nuclear fusion would be not the best of all possible, but in terms of the near future of something that we're close to, I think this is one of the most promising technologies that we have. If we can have economic synthetic solar, which is basically what it is, so you get a lot more energy out than you put in, that would be huge.
So that would mean theoretically coal as an electricity source goes away, hydro, if you can't build it, not a problem.
Yeah.
Why is that such a game changer in your view?
Well, as far as we know, it wouldn't contribute to global warming. And it would also take the same trends that we've had all along, which is we built civilization on the fact that we could find cheap energy. I mean, if this planet didn't have oil reserves or coal reserves, it's really hard to imagine how we would have gotten this far.
Yeah, how far do you think we would have gotten?
That's a really interesting question. Like, if you imagine that we only had wood how far along could we have gotten? Because we probably know enough now that we could maybe change the wood in some way. But whether we would have gotten as far as we had with wood only, I don't know. I haven't really kind of played it out. But that would be a wonderful counterfactual science fiction story if we replayed the Earth's history without the coal and oil reserves.
Here's a hard one, Kevin. What do you think will eventually lead to humankind's demise, if in fact there is such a thing?
I don't believe there'll be a demise of any sort. It'd be very, very difficult to eradicate all human life, even if you really wanted to. I mean, even asteroids, it would do a good job of killing most of the people, but not all the people. I think what will happen is we'll evolve until we're unrecognizable. That the way humanity disappears basically is we become something so different from what we are that we want to give it a different name. I also think that that's a plural. So I think our destiny is to be many species. And there will be people who will say under my dead body, will my genes or the genes of my offspring ever be changed? And then there are other people who will say, sign me up today.
What were you studying at college when you dropped out?
Geology.
Geology. All right. So let's imagine that instead of dropping out and traveling around Asia, then becoming this dude that you became, that you'd been a different kind of guy and you'd stayed in college and gotten your geology degree. What do you think you'd be doing today had you not taken that alternate path?
I might have made a good doctor because I think I'm really good at diagnosing things.
Medical diagnosis is so friggin' hard, isn't it?
Yes, it's hard. My wife actually runs a lab at Genentech. She's a biochemist, genetic engineer. So I hear how hard it is to unravel even the smallest bit of what's actually going on. And we still really, I mean, the brain, we don't know. The cell, you know, people's image of the cell, well, the cell is almost a solid. We think of it as kind of filled with water, but it's really, it's packed so much that there's almost no room for things to happen. And we don't even know how they happen, actually.
It's humbling, too, isn't it? Because you think as good as we humans have gotten at building systems, I mean, we can do air conditioning and even some nuclear power and this and that in terms of the most basic system, which we all own, we don't really know how it's put together and how it got that way.
And to make matters more complicated, I think we are making our technology, like the internet and robots and things like that, almost as complex as biological systems. And so my books have been about how we need to bring in biological thinking into our technology. We have to understand that they're related, that they're cousins, or if not brothers and sisters, and that our technology will become more biological as it progresses. And so this requires a different approach to what we make.
Last question, Kevin. What was the question that I should have asked you but failed to?
You didn't ask me if I was on a time machine, where I would go.
Okay. Kevin, if you were on a time machine, where would you go?
I would go into the future, and I would go about 200 years. I think further than that, I would just be lost.
And what would you want to see 200 years out?
I would give so much just to get a sense of the trajectory of the cosmos, because I think we're really blinded and short-sighted and particularly swayed by the last 100 years. And so the question is, is there really a trajectory to our development and our progress? And I think 200 years would give me enough time for a second data point.
Would you make it a point to seek out your own great-great-great-great-grandchildren, or would you avoid them?
I'd probably wouldn't do that, but I would Google myself.
See how well you held up.
Because the honest truth is that even in 200 years, not one single one of us here is going to be remembered.
All right. I make you this promise. If I somehow get frozen, boiled, whatever, and make it that long, I'm going to tell people about you.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Kevin, nice talking to you. Thank you very much.
It was great.
Bye-bye.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. If you can't wait that long, you can get our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe.